Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management's Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representation as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. The information is general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. If you have any questions, please email david.lundgren@hancockwhitney.com. On today's call, we have David Lundgren, our Chief Investment Officer, who will serve as the moderator. We have Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton and Investment Directors Richard Chauvin, Jeffrey Tangus, and Martin Serrera. And with that, I'll pass the call on to Dave.
Good morning. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you all for joining us for this special edition of our monthly call. For this particular call, we're going to do something a little bit differently, and we've done this, I guess, really for the last 6 or 7 years. We're going to go ahead and start off by maybe reviewing the major stories of the prior year, 2019, and then try to give you some thoughts on how 2020 is going to shape up. It really was a fantastic year. 2019 is one of the best years for asset classes in memory and, arguably on record. And really, to get a full appreciation of what a great year it was, you really need to think about what 2018 was like and how the year ended as we entered 2019. And I know sometimes memories are short, but 2018 was an incredibly difficult year. We had a lot of uncertainty on some major issues, Brexit, concerns about the Fed tightening, concerns about U.S.-China trade negotiations just completely falling apart. And we had 3 market corrections over the course of 2018, which is really unusual to have 3 corrections in 2018 in a given year. And the really big one occurred in December, leading right into Christmas Eve, where the S&P 500 was down almost 20%. So it wasn't a great way to start the year. And not only was the S&P 500 down, but basically all of the major asset classes and many of the sub-asset classes were in negative territory. Only money market and intermediate high-quality bonds were able to eke out small gains. So incredibly difficult year. Moving into 2019, it was the complete opposite. And we're going to talk a little bit about those details, but we really went from one of the worst years for asset class returns to one of the best years. And Richard's going to get into the details in a little bit further along into the call, but, you know, unlike 2018 where everything was negative, this year we had everything positive with many market indices producing double-digit returns. So it was a really welcomed, nice turnaround and very exciting to have such a great year for our clients and investors all across the spectrum. What we'd like to do is maybe, again, just kind of recap some of the major issues of 2019, and I'm going to go around the room figuratively and just kind of ask people for their opinions on what the biggest headliner of 2019 was. And we're going to start with Richard Chauvin. And, Richard, I just want to give you kudos. I think anybody that's been in this business for a long time knows how difficult it is to predict outcomes, whether it be regarding events or market returns. And you were pretty spot on your call regarding U.S.-China trade negotiations. It's a topic that, you know, for our regular listeners, you've been talking about this particular topic for almost 2 years. You're very well versed in it. And, I can remember back in spring where a lot of prognosticators and the market felt like we were on the verge of getting a deal signed, and you felt pretty good that it wasn't going to happen. So I'm kind of stealing your thunder on the biggest headliner, but talk a little bit just about, the year in review in terms of that particular part of the U.S.-China trade negotiations.
Sure, Dave, and thank you. I guess in the interest of time, I'm going to try to go through some of the major events that occurred regarding trade in 2019, but I'm really going to start in May because I think that's when things got really tough, and I think the escalation in the trade war, dispute, whatever you want to call it, really culminated in May when, despite the fact that there had been a lot of negotiations done, a pretty significantly long trade agreement had been drafted, and then President Trump found out that China had basically removed or, you know, sort of backed out of a number of the things that had been agreed to verbally and were in the document, and they decided they didn't want them in there. And this was in May, so Trump quickly decided at that point to increase the tariffs on about $200 billion in imports from 10% to 25%. I think China was fairly shocked. They were on their way to the U.S. to have further negotiations, and they canceled the trip. That was the first big escalation, and I think that was the major story of the year when that happened. There were lots of twists and turns after that. I'm only going to hit a few highlights of those in the interest of time. But the other thing that happened following that was U.S. decided to restrict U.S. Telecommunications parts companies from selling goods to Huawei, the major global network provider based in China, which was another sticking point and angered China very much. But in June, President Trump and Xi had a meeting at the G20 summit and agreed to a truce after lots of escalation that had occurred already by summer. And so things got a little quiet, and then the Hong Kong protest started over the legislation to allow extradition of Hong Kong's citizens for certain legal infractions to be extracted to the mainland for prosecution. That was extremely unacceptable to Hong Kong citizens. They protested. The U.S. made some comments. U.S. administration and congressional members made comments about this, supporting the protesters. It angered China, and China said, please remove your, quote, black hands from these protests. Felt like that the U.S. was helping to foment those protests. So things got worse, as you can see. In August, again, Trump escalated again, stated he was going to add a 10% tariff on another $300 billion in Chinese goods. And that, at that point, the yuan, the Chinese currency, dropped below, above $7. And the U.S. then labeled China a currency manipulator at that point. So, again, things were still getting worse in terms of the environment for trade negotiations. Then the Senate, the U.S. Senate changed the rules about the federal pension plans and to disallow federal dollars to go into Chinese securities, which they felt was supporting China state businesses. So that, again, was another sticking point with China, got them further angry. But then things began to settle down. The negotiators agreed to meet in October, and Larry Kudlow announced in November that there were going to be negotiations on an advanced level. That would mean lower-level negotiators were going to meet to try to set the groundwork for serious negotiations by the senior team, including Mnuchin and Navarro and Lighthizer. And then things began to get better and better. Kudlow said in November the deal was down to some short strokes to get it done. We had one more setback in November, however, when Trump signed the bill that Congress had passed almost unanimously supporting the protesters in Hong Kong. But even despite that, Trump was able to get a deal done with the negotiators, and in December, just before the second round of tariffs were going to go into effect, to escalate tariffs even further. That was stopped. The deal is about to be signed. It's still not signed, but it's all drafted and supposedly translated into both languages. And a scheduled meeting is on the 15th of January to sign a deal. So with all that, with all those twists and turns and ups and downs, the market stayed relatively optimistic most of the time during the year, allowing the great financial market year that you described. So I'll stop there, Dave. Yep. Those are some highlights.
Yep. Great. Lots going on there, obviously. Paul Teaton, biggest headliner of 2019. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. Well, trade was clearly the main event in 2019, which Richard has reported on thoroughly there. And the bottom line was that growth slowed around the world pretty significantly. The U.S. had experienced the strongest growth in the decade. In 2018, real growth around 3.2%, and it slowed to 2.2% in 2019. Pretty big impact from trade would be our assessment as the main driver of that. In the Eurozone, growth was relatively steady around 1.2%. The UK drifted a little slower in the year, 1.4 to 1.2. Japan flatlining around zero was minus 0.2 in 2018 and plus 0.4 in 2019. So the U.S. was the standout among the developed economies with 2.2%. It gave us a reasonably strong dollar, even though interest rates were declining starting in the middle of the year. Manufacturing conditions in the U.S. deteriorated sharply and abroad as well, and capital spending slowed to a standstill in both the U.S. and in Europe. A couple of key Fed studies pointed to tariffs being responsible for a lot of the headwind in the manufacturing sector, pointing to the higher input costs that manufacturers had to pay for imported components, far outweighing the benefits of protection from tariffs. And a second report published in September spotlighted the uncertainty relating to trade was the biggest part of the negative headwind to trade to capital spending in 2019. And as the Phase One deal came into focus in December, expectations for a little better economic environment in 2020 were relying on that study, that the reduction of uncertainty, the clarity of the trade picture would have a positive effect on capital spending. U.S. consumers carried the economy in 2019. The household sector is still very healthy, has strong balance sheets. They've paid off a lot of debt. They have real income growth is a pretty decent rate, but there is a noticeable residual frugality that lingers from 2008. Real personal consumption expenditures hit a high point around 4.5% in the second quarter, and our estimate for fourth quarter is right around 2%, so pretty significant slowing in the second half of the year in household spending. So despite still high consumer confidence and full employment, household spending in the U.S. continues to be pretty subdued. So those are the main outlines of the economic picture in 2019, Dave.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Jeff, quickly, biggest headline of 2019. Hey, good morning.
Well, I think it's the Fed and Jay Powell. I think they get the MVP award for 2019. I'm going to call that the Most Valuable Policymaker Award. And why is that? Well, you think about all the things the Fed had to face in 2019, the slowing economy around the globe, inverted yield curves, a trade dispute with almost everybody on the planet, and then Brexit out there. There was a lot going on. The Fed's mandate, of course, full employment and stable prices. They had a lot to think about. And, of course, coming out of 2018, as you mentioned earlier, there were a lot of challenges and difficult markets that they were working on the heels of. But in 2019, really in early 2019, the Fed, much to its credit, began messaging and communicating to the markets that they were sensitive to what was going on and that they were going to basically stand behind the economy and make sure that things didn't grow too weak. And then, of course, in June, they started cutting rates, or July, I think it was. They started cutting rates, three successive rate cuts, responding decisively and forcefully to all those threats in the economy. So, you know, the Fed has a reputation of sometimes being slow to react, but I think Jay Powell and the Fed this year really were right on the mark in terms of responding. And then when it came time in October to communicate to the market that it was going to move to the sidelines, they also did that successfully. So both moving into action and then moving to the sidelines, the Fed was really right on all the marks in terms of communication, messaging, and just the right amount of stimulus to the economy to accomplish their goal without becoming too aggressive. So Jay Powell and the Fed, I think, get the MVP award for 2019.
All right. We'll send them a trophy. Martin, real quick, biggest headliner of 2019.
Well, Dave, 2019 was what is often referred to in our business as a year of stock markets climbing the wall of worry, and I'm not going to repeat all the things that my colleagues just said, but there were a lot of negative headlines throughout the year, and each time one of those negative headlines either resolved itself or moved away, moved out of the picture, stocks continued to climb higher. And so it's really been a year of sort of relaxation of fear for all those various reasons. And as you started the call with, it was a gangbuster year. The S&P 500 up over 31%.
No doubt. It was definitely more of a risk-on environment and less fear from market participants, which led to some of those healthy returns. All right, that's old news. Let's go ahead and give our thoughts on, you know, what are the issues that you believe are going to shape 2020? New year, some of the same issues. And, Richard, we'll start with you, and I know what you're going to talk about. And you mentioned about a Phase 1 agreement being signed, I believe, on January 15th is what's been announced. Is it going to happen? Is it durable? And what about a Phase 2 deal? Any thoughts on that?
I do think a Phase 1 deal is going to happen. I don't think that's a very heroic prediction at this point. There's been strong incentives to get this one done. It was the relatively easy part of an overall deal, yet it was still apparently difficult to get done, given the, you know, twists and turns, the loss of trust. But the phase two, which China doesn't even really mention, Trump mentions it a lot, and supposedly those negotiations are going to kick off pretty shortly, according to President Trump, but again, no mention of this by China. I do not expect much progress on Phase 2 negotiations this year, and I think that does create some risk. I don't know what the consensus view in the market is, but I think many people that I've read their writings on this do not have high hopes for a Phase 2 deal anytime in 2020, despite the fact that there are good incentives on both sides to get further progress on the books. I think the strongest incentive on the negative side is China is unwilling to grant further concessions to the things it holds most dear when there's an election coming at the end of 2020, and perhaps there's a chance they could be in front of a less passionate negotiator in the future, so they may want to hold off on giving away anything else in terms of concessions. So that's why I think a Phase 2 deal won't happen in 2020.
All right. We shall see. Paul Keaton, biggest issue for 2020?
Well, 2020 is probably going to look a lot like 2019, I think, in a macroeconomic sense, both in the U.S. And globally. Our base case is 1.5% to 2% growth in real GDP in the U.S. on a year-to-year basis this year. So that's down from the 2.2% that we are likely to see with the final numbers for 2019, and as I mentioned earlier, down from 3.2% 2018. So it's really a slower growth environment around the world. Looks like the fourth quarter is running around 1.6% seasonally adjusted annual rate. Street expectations are 1.7% in the first quarter. I think those are pretty reasonable. We're going to assume that there is some kind of benefit from reduced uncertainty and that capital spending kicks in a little bit in the second half. So second half ought to be a little better. Maybe running 2 to 2.5% seasonally adjusted annual rate quarters, which should cause the year-to-year number for the fourth quarter to be around right around 2%. So pretty close to where it is, maybe a little slower than 2019. So the assumptions there are that the Phase 1 trade deal doesn't blow up and that there are no additional tariff escalations. Also assumes there's no phase two deal, as Richard indicated, and we get a small positive impact to capital spending. We're assuming core inflation remains around 2%, plus or minus, that payroll growth continues at a healthy 150,000 to 200,000 a month, that World War III doesn't start in the Middle East, and that there's no recession in the U.S. So basically expect a little stronger growth outlook because of the phase one, and it would be a little better outlook if we actually got started on phase two. But I think, as I agree with Richard, that that's unlikely. So global growth, similar picture. Trends in 2019 were around 3% real growth, which is pretty darn sluggish for a global economy. Expectations are that it's going to firm up to 3.5, largely because of the benefits of reduced uncertainty related to tariffs. Recession warnings abounded in 2019 in Germany and the Eurozone. And want to emphasize that 3.5% real GDP trends for the global economy is still very sluggish. Street expectations are for the Eurozone this year 1.1%, Germany 1, UK 1.5, Japan 1.0, China 5.9, although nobody really believes those numbers. Credible street studies that we think are reliable point to around 3% growth in China this year. That sounds pretty good. Although the change is down from 12% trends that prevailed prior to the crash of 2008, which was a global event, not just a disaster in the U.S. So the global economy is really continues to have a hard time recovering from that, China included. The U.S. At around 2% growth should still be the standout economy in the developed world. And that should be supportive for the dollar. So the other thing to note is that the world continues to struggle with persistently low inflation. The five-year forward market-based inflation swaps, which are basically inflation expectation measures, are 1.3 in the Eurozone, 0.1 in Japan, and 1.6 in the U.S. So low inflation continues to be a problem for the global economy and a concern among policymakers who see a lot of risk of deflationary conditions, particularly in Europe and Japan. We don't want to see that spread to the United States. That's the story on our base case, Dave.
Great. Thank you, Paul. You touched on something I think is worth mentioning, and it's an ongoing developing situation, but, you know, the whole Iran-Mideast conflict situation that's going on right now, you know, that's, you know, obviously an event that, you know, could become a more substantial issue as we move forward. Obviously, none of us know how that's going to play out, but at least something I think worth mentioning that you touched on. Hey, Martin, what do you think? Pressing issue for 2020.
Well, certainly, Dave, the November elections in the U.S. are going to be a big focal point for the markets as we move along, and we're not about to get into any prognostication here, but, you know, the difference between the two major parties in the U.S. couldn't be more stark, and what I mean is, you know, one side has a view that lowering burdens on business activity and profit production is a good idea, and the expectation that better growth results will result in better revenues to fund all the things that they want to spend money on. And the other side has the opposite view, that increasing burdens on profit-generating activities will raise revenues without stifling growth. So it's going to be pretty important for the markets as we get closer and closer to November. And it's not just the executive branch, it's all three, it's the executive branch in both houses of Congress.
Absolutely. Yep, great point. Jeff Tangus, most pressing issue for 2020.
Well, from my perspective, the challenge is really generating income in a fixed income portfolio coming on the heels of 2019. Starting with the base case, the yield on intermediate-term bonds taxable bonds is around 2%, broad market 2.25%. So that's kind of where we start the year for generating return in 2020. But it's going to be more challenging than last year. As we mentioned, last year almost everything worked. So this year, without having the Fed working aggressively, and with a economy, as Paul mentioned, that it could be modestly slower this year, that we think it's more important this year for returns to focus on higher quality securities and really focus on protecting principal. We don't want to be too aggressive. We want to keep an eye on rising default rates in the high yield bond markets. That's always a reason for some caution. We want to maintain a nice balanced fixed income portfolio. We believe that longer-term rates, 10-year Treasury, for example, are probably in a trading range. So there seems to be some opportunity there to make some money, buy bonds when we're at the top of the trading range and sell some bonds when we're towards the bottom of the trading range. That might help us augment that 2 to 2.25% return. And then finally, what we really need to do, what's really important is to stay on the lookout for any unexpected slowdown in the economy. If that happens, the Fed may move back into a more active role. Right now, the Fed funds futures markets imply the Fed not really doing anything until December of this year. They want to wait out the presidential election. But if something unforeseen happened, that could change things pretty dramatically, and we want to be prepared and ready to take advantage of that. So I think that's our pressing need for 2020.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Let's move on. And, you know, we've talked several times about what a great year it was for a lot of asset classes. Richard, if you could, very, very high level, just kind of give us some of the highlights of 2019 before we move into some of our outlook for both stock and bond markets. Richard?
Sure, Dave. I'll hit a few highlights, as you said. Martin mentioned that the S&P 500 had a 31.5% return for the year, and just outstanding. These overall, I'll just say that easy money policies that have been mentioned here led to the best overall asset class returns since 2009. you know, consistent with our theme of positioning, U.S. growth stocks outperform value stocks across all ranges, large, mid, and small cap. The best performer of all was the Russell top 200 growth stocks, up 36.5%. Yet you can't scoff at international stocks either. The Europe Asia Far East Index up 21.7%. Emerging market stocks had a good year, up over 18%. High yield, a great year as spreads narrowed when the Fed eased policy, up 14.3%. And emerging market bonds also had a good year, up over 15%. As China stimulated its economy to thwart the effects of trade war, and there was optimism about that truce that I mentioned across EM markets. So those are a few highlights to show you what a great year it was.
Excellent. Thank you, Richard. Martin, you heard Richard kind of highlight some of the returns. Is there anything you want to add regarding 2019 before we get into a discussion about 2020?
Yeah, Dave, in line with my comments earlier about a relaxation of fear and Jeff and Richard also pointed out at some point during the summertime, the fear was at the highest and the yield curve inverted for an ever so brief moment at the end of August. Since the end of August, the return differentials have tightened and in some cases reversed. And what I mean is, you know, Richard pointed out how growth has dramatically outperformed value and the U.S. has outperformed other regions. But since the end of August, the returns have been a heck of a lot closer. So we are seeing a little bit of a shift. We don't know whether it's a durable shift, but we are seeing a little bit of a shift towards what we might think are normal equity results where higher risk categories are delivering a little bit better returns. Just a highlight on that, for example, S&P 500 up about 12.5% since the end of August. The ACWI ex-US equity index up over 13%. Emerging market index up 16%. So a big change in market character for the latter part of 2019.
Okay. So 2019, looking back, is easy, right? Trying to make predictions on where we go in 2020. As you heard, there are so many variables and so many issues that could impact market returns. So instead of giving our listeners, an expected return number, what we've done in the past is really kind of talk about the bullish case and then the bearish case for the market. And Martin, if you could, walk us through what may happen or what needs to happen for us to have a good year in stocks, however that's defined. I mean, I would describe a good year as, you know, high single digits and upward. Martin, the bullish case?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely, Dave. It's a continuum, right? So 2019 was the relaxation of fear, and I think that continues over into 2020. And the backdrop is important to consider here. So the consumer segment is extremely healthy in the U.S. We are still looking for evidence of a pickup in consumer expenditures. As Paul pointed out earlier, consumers are being fairly frugal, but wage growth has been high. Unemployment is generationally low. Unemployment across demographic groups is extremely low. College degree unemployment is below 3%, well, close to 2%. High school diploma unemployment is around 5%. So the consumer segment is very healthy. Wage growth among the lowest quintile wage earners is growing at the fastest pace. And it's really been a pickup from the couple of years of very sluggish growth. So consumer segment's very healthy. Corporate segment is fairly healthy but acting a little concerned. And what I mean there is balance sheets are not stretched in the corporate environment. I think net debt to cash flow is at 1.7 times, so it's right in line with a 50-year mean of that measure of corporate balance sheet health. But corporate leadership is a little worried, and so CapEx has been a weak point over the last couple of quarters. CapEx growth has been really absent or sluggish, and so we've had a couple of years of stagnation. So as we go into 2020, we're going to be looking for, you know, how all this health results into a resumption of growth. 2019 was a year of 0% growth in top-line sales for the S&P 500 and earnings for the S&P 500. And currently the street expects a pretty good acceleration, to earnings growth of around 10% for the S&P 500. And we think that's a fairly reasonable expectation at this point in time. So a resumption of growth based on a fairly healthy environment for consumers and for businesses. As we get deeper into the year, and maybe there are some green shoots of things picking up around the world, maybe CEO sentiment picks up and CapEx spending starts to turn upward. Investment spending is a very powerful driver of corporate revenues and corporate profits, so that's going to be a key thing to look for in the year. But really it's going to be the absence of bad things, because as we may have already talked about, well, there's scant evidence of a recession on the horizon. So relaxation of fear, resumption of growth, absence of major negatives, that's the case for a good year in stocks.
Sounds like a winning formula. Paul Teton, you have the unfortunate job of throwing cold water on Martin's outlook. What could go wrong, or why are you concerned about equity markets 2020?
Yes, this discussion could well earn me a nickname, something like Dr. Doom. But I do want to emphasize that I'm approaching this from the standpoint of pretty much like you said, what could go wrong. I think our base case is pretty solid. And so I'm going to try to describe if conditions were worse than what we're projecting, what would that look like? And essentially, last year, the bull case was a relatively easy call. The fourth quarter of 2018 was so awful that some kind of rebound was highly likely, and we were able to see some of the key moving parts start to move in the right direction early on. This year, a more subdued equity market seems like a pretty easy call. The 31% return last year was kind of an outlier. That's an uncharitable way to call the best year we've seen in a long time. And over the 2 years, including the bad correction in the fourth quarter of 18, the over 12.5% compound growth over the 2 years is really spectacular. So it seems like a breather is warranted for the markets. PEs are elevated, while global economic conditions really remain fairly muted. So the bear case for 2020 that I'm going to outline, I want to emphasize, does not include the outbreak of World War III or a U.S. recession. It's predicated more on an unraveling of the Phase One trade deal and potential disappointment in the White House that there's not much movement to occur on a Phase Two deal. So President Trump has demonstrated a proclivity to express that disappointment by reimposing tariffs, so that seems to be a pretty live possibility here. And were that to happen, a return to a pretty gloomy outlook for global growth is the likely outcome. If U.S. real GDP growth were to slip below our lower bound of 1.5% trends, say towards 1%, there would be elevated concern over continuing deflationary conditions in Europe and Japan, potentially spreading to the U.S. The Fed would likely re-engage in quantitative easing, cutting the Fed funds rate below 1% towards a half a percent, 50 basis points to 75 basis points level would be my guess, down from 1.5% rates currently. Concerns over a burgeoning federal deficit already at about $1 trillion expected for this fiscal year, with slower growth, expectations are going to be moving much higher for the federal budget deficit. So basically, with global central banks all back in the quantitative easing game, driving interest rates very low or negative in a lot of places, hopefully not here, but I think prevalent negative interest rates in Europe and Japan would be the story. It's just a poor global outlook that with these low negative rates sapping dynamism of economies and interfering with savings and capital investment planning, and just makes growth, which is the antidote to deflation, much more difficult to achieve. So a pretty gloomy outlook. Again, I want to emphasize that's not our base case. And my job here is to describe what something worse would look like. So that's my call on it, Dave.
Okay. Great points for us to consider and watch. And thank you, Paul, for laying out that bearish case for us. Jeff, you know, we talked a lot about 2019. You know, the Fed eased three times. We saw basically rates across the whole curve come down, leading to pretty good returns that Richard talked about across all fixed income classes. Let's just talk about 2020. What's going to happen in 2020 in the bond world, Jeff?
Well, I guess the base case is the Fed stays on the sidelines. They do what they say they're going to do. They don't cut rates. So that takes capital appreciation out of the equation for 2020, if in fact that actually is how things work out. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, right now Fed Fund futures are implying a cut maybe in December, but we'll have to see about that. So short rates are likely to remain anchored because the Fed is on the sideline. Longer-term rates, we'll call it the Treasury 10-year, we believe it's trading in a range right now from 1.75% to 2.25%. So that presents some opportunities, but ultimately it tells you rates go up, rates go down. But as long as the economy doesn't catch fire or fall off a cliff, that range is likely to hold up. Corporate bond spreads have narrowed to historical tight spreads versus Treasury, so we're not going to get a lot of extra return out of the corporate bond market. And as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing some spotty default rate pickup in the high yield area, mostly on the retail and the energy sector. So it's not widespread. Not a real big cause for concern there, but something worth keeping an eye on. So the base case here on 2020 is that, again, short rates stay fairly stable, long rates trade back and forth in a fairly moderate range, without a dramatic move higher in interest rates. Paul mentioned that the Fed will be selling a lot of bonds to finance the deficit. You know, we'll see how that impacts things. It doesn't look like that's going to be a big issue at this point, so we'll have to keep an eye on that. But I think this year for 2020, the rule is going to be collect the coupon on the bond, protect the portfolio, and get through this year with a nice positive return.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. And great points. You know, no one really gets excited about bonds, especially in a year like last year when we had so many double-digit returns from risk assets. But, you know, as you heard, the markets are always facing issues. We talked a lot about some of the issues facing 2020, but that's always true. You know, we're always dealing with geopolitical issues and elections that could shape markets. And, you know, it's just important. You know, bonds play a role. They're there to, as Jeff mentioned, to protect principal, offset some of the volatility that might be experienced in equity markets, and collect coupons or income. And that's why when we're building portfolios for our clients, we need to get a really good understanding of your situation and think from a longer-term perspective to make sure that we're building a portfolio that's appropriate for your situation. So we're going to end the call there. Thank you so much for joining us. Join us again next month. Our call will be on Tuesday, February 4th. Thank you.